Welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhellman. In today's show, we're again going to be speaking about systems change in food production. Now, we often chat about regenerative agriculture on the show, all the benefits to planetary stability, human health, animal welfare, and a living wage for those growing the food. When it comes to the living soil itself, we've learned that the process of regenerative can be best described as everything is renewed in the process of using it. This means the systems supporting how we feed ourselves ultimately are fueled by the perpetual and renewed nutrient cycling process in the soil. As Dr. Elaine Ingham shared with us, when it comes to soil food web, one trophic level's trash is another's treasure. With that, there's been increased interest in regenerative ocean farming. The substrate holding the living ecosystem and ecology may be different, but the principles are similar. With regenerative ocean farming, it's an aquatic farming system that grows seaweed and shellfish with no inputs. As with terrestrial production, in this case, regen is all about investing in the ecological health of the aquatic ecosystem to create good food. Today, I welcome two dynamic leaders who are directly responsible for shepherding regen ocean farming into the mainstream. First, the president and CEO of Atlantic Sea Farms, Bree Warner. Bree, thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me, Aaron. It's really fun to be here.
Well, it's always a pleasure. This is probably your third appearance that we've had chats in, and we've gotten to know you so well over the last couple of years. Thanks again for taking the time.
And the world changes a whole lot in between each one, too.
Doesn't it, though? It's amazing. All right. And also, hey, a good friend and also a dynamic leader in the space, the CEO of Island Creek Oysters, Chris Sherman. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Aaron. How are you, man? Good to be back.
Always a pleasure, my friend. Always making good things happen in Duxbury. Chris, dealing with sea ice, dealing with frozen conditions in February, but fighting the good fight, right?
Every day.
So, Chris, I think the last time the three of us saw each other in person was during a gathering at Island Creek when you opened your new campus down in Duxbury Harbor. This place, which seems like pretty much a game changer for you and your team, for the company as a whole, but also seemed for the industry. What's the latest coming out of your epicenter for aquaculture advancement down in Duxbury?
Yeah, it's a great question, Aaron. You know, the kind of the backstory on our farm here in Duxbury is that as we scaled, you know, a lot of shellfish aquaculture, particularly here in the Northeast, is operating in some of the most densely populated areas of North America. So user interactions and other constraints are a major strategic challenge to growth and scale within the industry. So one of the bottlenecks that we identified is really working waterfront access. It's really at a scarcity here in New England as recreational uses and residential land uses in the upland have grown. Access for working watermen has decreased. So one of the big moves that we did was to buy the campus that you referenced. And it was an old marine research facility that had been in place for many, many decades. And as a result, had maintained this kind of 12-acre waterfront campus in Duxbury. And it was going to become condos because, you know, who could use a facility like that? But then with the growth of our business, we were able to kind of not only take a run at it, be able to, you know, we made a big bet, but you know, try to just afford it. But we also were able to kind of move in and utilize a lot of the existing infrastructure, you know, deep water docks and equipment, wet laboratories. So what it's done for us is really provided a platform where we can now confidently scale and run our business on, you know, a time horizon like we've always wanted to, many decades, rather than just figuring it out how to move forward every 18 months. So it's been transformational. And as far as the impact on the industry, I would say one of the key elements has just been, you know, landings here in Duxbury. We're a distributor of oysters as well as a producer. So that's been big. But the pivotal thing has been we moved into an old wet lab on campus and we're able to finally scale our hatchery where we actually produce seed, which is a major supply constraint for the growth of aquaculture here in the Northeast. And we've been able to scale that facility up to commercial production and now are a meaningful player within the seed supply. And to put things in perspective, We've seen, you know, exponential growth in farm shellfish production over the last 10 or 15 years, but the number of hatcheries has only increased here in the Northeast really by one at commercial scale, and it's ours. So that has been, in our view, a value add to the future of the industry. And while we still, you know, we work through kinks just like every hatchery does, we're actually contributing meaningfully to the seed supply. And then with the additional infrastructure, we're able to kind of buy a lot of those oysters back and create markets and set up a much more stable value chain as a result. So it's been a win-win and very much a work in progress. I find myself playing, you know, kind of moonlighting as a real estate developer these days, which I would love to stop doing at some point. But overall, it's been just a major success and a boon for the business and for shellfish aquaculture.
Yeah, I thought I've seen you popping up those collars a lot more like the real estate developers do, but maybe I'm wrong.
One thing I haven't done yet is put on a suit. So they drag Chris, me before the ZBA one more time, I might have to. So
yeah, Chris, I feel like you and I wouldn't even know where to find one.
I know, it's challenging.
Too far on the suit, too far, yeah. So, hey, Chris, let me just get this right. And so our audience understands this, that you grow out your own seed and spat. You grow the feed stuff, the algae to raise the oysters. You sell this seed to other growers. You run your own farms, which grow out these seeds from adolescence to maturity. You aggregate and distribute the mature oysters to diverse retailers and food service relationships. Some of those are including your own restaurants. You invest in preserving and improving the marine ecological system to grow out your crop. You have a lab to push the envelope on the technology. And you offer one of the more pristine and chill dining experiences from a raw bar down on the campus. So many, many moving parts, but really it seems like it's the entire regenerative ocean farming stack. Like you've had that in mind from day one. Was that always the plan or did it just develop that way?
You know, we've become, you know, to your point, Aaron, we've become completely vertically integrated, you know, kind of spanning the entire value chain from seed to consumer. And, I think to say that it was always the plan would be, you know, shining probably a generous light on our business practices over the last, you know, 10 or 15 years. We've learned a lot, that's for sure. But, you know, the level of intentionality there was really we were reacting and just forging this thing in an industry that really, even when I started here 13 years ago, it was just in its infancy. So a lot of it was born out of necessity. But one of the concepts that as we kind of now are able to look back on all that growth and the kind of the adventure that we've been on, you know, one of the things we've really landed on is coastal communities. And that, I think, is the kind of the way to wrap up regenerative aquaculture and its value here on the coast is that through its benefit for the economy, the kind of social, cultural, gastronomic benefit that we get, you know, nutritional. And also the environmental aspect, you know, which gets at this concept of, you know, adding that value back into the environment on which we depend to produce, you know, this food. It really culminates in this coastal community concept. And that's something we've really made core to our vision and mission at Island Creek. And I think, frankly, it's why a lot of people work for us and why they buy our product is that kind of round table benefit. So. You know, moves like opening the hatchery and you know, acquiring this campus and continuing to kind of grow in our distribution endeavors and even the restaurants, which are fun, but also great platforms to kind of educate the public and the diners about, you know, why they can feel good about what they're eating has been a great journey and certainly not over yet. Still a lot of work to be done, but we've learned so much along the way.
Yeah. Well, it's also a unique identifier for New England, right? I mean, there's so much nostalgia tied to these coastal communities, and also it's an opportunity for innovation economy. So good stuff, Chris. Bree, so speaking of the time we met down in Duxbury at Chris's new campus, I believe you at the time had recently taken over CEO and president of Atlantic Sea Farms, if it even had that name at that point, but you were on a fact-finding mission to figure out how to scale up existing kelp production with
them. Yeah, it was actually just before that. I was at the Island Institute thinking about how do we scale up. I was doing exactly that, a fact-finding message, like how do we scale up aquaculture in Maine? And Chris's was just a perfect example of that as we were getting fishermen in the water. Because our question was mostly around how do we get back to Chris's point about preserving working waterfront. Mm-hmm. Preserving coastal communities is also a way to do that, making sure that people who work on the water are making good enough income that they can afford to keep the properties in those communities. And so that's really where we were focused. And so when you came down there and we met Chris and his operation, it was just a really good setting off point for our partner farmers, our fishermen that we were working with at the Island Institute, who were learning about getting into oysters, mussels, and seaweed. Like, hey, this is possible, and it's possible to do on these coastal communities and keep them revitalized and keep that water working waterfront working.
Well, what I always find interesting, and I share this with other audiences, is your innovation within the distribution channel, within who those farmers actually became. Could you share with everyone who ultimately became the farmers of the kelp and how you're able to create a unique economic model to get more people engaged in this?
Yeah. So, I mean, because of people like Chris and some leaders here in Maine, like Bill Mook and, you know, Tony Simmons, and people who really kind of have paved the way for oyster farmers in the Northeast, it's more of a well-trodden path. People kind of see the path. It is very difficult, but the path has been forged. Same to a point with mussels. What wasn't sort of forged here is seaweed. And, you know, we have 4,000 plus lobster holders in the state of Maine, all of whose primary dependence is on one fishery. There are a few people who scallop, but other than that, it's just lobster. And as Chris can say, in Massachusetts, there's a little bit more diversity, but even there, we're seeing sort of more and more of leaning toward monocultures in the fisheries. And here in Maine, we have historically have really had small boats, owner-operator farms. There's a whole history as to why. But guys used to catch cod and shrimp and have kind of five different seasons, and lobster was one of those five. Now, you know, lobster is very much faded from south of us, but lobster is booming here. In fact, the 10 of the best years in recorded history for lobster in the state of Maine has been in the last 15. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Primary, you know, the two main ones being one, we have a very conservation-minded fishery up here that is pretty different from any other managed fishery in the States, in that it is an owner-operator fishery and you can't sell your license. So just to kind of put a finer point on what that means, if your boat is out fishing, the license holder must be on that boat. And most other fisheries in the country, some salmon fisheries excluded, that is not the case. So what that means is it's kind of the power consolidated in a very few who can own 5, 6, 7 boats, and people work on those boats. Up here, the owner is the one who's working on that boat. So there's a little bit more of a cognizance of what's going on. I think the fact that people can't sell their licenses either, like you're not going to make money from your license because you quite literally aren't allowed to sell it, means that there is more of an investment for the future, because the only way that people can really get into the fishery up here is if they go through a young apprenticeship program at this point. And that means it's a generational fishery. So there's nothing to be made from your license, and their children and their grandchildren and their grandchildren's children are able to get in the fishery, and really nobody else is. So with a generational fishery in mind and an owner operator mindset and smaller boats, people have put things in place like a V-notch in their tail, which they're not doing in Massachusetts or Canada, where they're basically taking a slice out of the female, an egg-bearing female's tail. And that doesn't grow out for about 5 years. And anyone who sells a V-notch lobster can lose their license. And so it's basically preserving that breeding stock. But we also have an upper and lower size limit. So if you're getting a big lobster on your plate, it's not from Maine. We let those guys in the water to continue to breed and make a bigger population. So that's the optimistic side of why we're having a lobster boom. The very dark and scary side is that the Gulf of Maine is warming faster than 99% of oceans in the world. And there's a number of reasons for that, including the confluence of currents that's resulting from the Arctic ice melt. But our Gulf is warming so fast that we're seeing the warmer sides of the population decrease quickly, because the lobster larvae are no longer able to survive at the rate that they used to. Now, they're still surviving higher rate than they were 20 years ago, but the curve is very scary as to at what point scientists believe that the larvae are not going to continue to be successful at that rate. So I've just basically set up all these opportunities and challenges, but the kind of cliff notes of it is that we are facing one of the biggest changes in our ecosystem, and we are completely dependent on a lobster fishery that is not going to survive at the same rate it is now. The opportunity statement, however, is there's 4,000 boats out there with people who know the water better than anything, and right now are doing well, so they have capital. So getting into oysters and mussels is a little bit different when you have a lot of the capital to do it and you have the knowledge and the boat experience. I know that Chris knows this well, is like a lot of people want to be oyster farmers or mussel farmers or scallop farmers, but they don't know how to drive a boat and they aren't used to February temperatures in the ocean. That's not the case for these 4,000 plus lobster license holders and their sternmen. But the other opportunity statement here is, prior to us coming on the market, 99% of the seaweed that was eaten in the United States, which is a very quickly growing category with seaweed snacks and sushi and everything else, was imported from Asia with compromised waters, compromised labor practices, and it's all entirely dry. So we had this opportunity here in Maine to have fishermen farm kelp on their off season, because it happens opposite lobster, with the same equipment they're using in lobster, and really create the first time in US where people were able to get fresh line grown kelp, that they know where it's coming from. They know it's grown by fishing communities and it's clean and fresh. So that's really where we got into the market. And I took over as CEO in 2018, and we have grown from 30,000 pounds produced in 2018 to about 1.2 million is what we'll be harvesting this year, with 27 partner farmers, all of whom are fishermen looking to diversify their income in the face of climate change.
Fantastic. I mean, Bree, but so now you're winning all kinds of food and entrepreneurial environmental awards. You've begun bringing seaweed to the mainstream audience through your unique formats like smoothie cubes, and you partner with Sweet Greens, and even the World Economic Forum is singing your praises as a revolutionary sustainable food for climate action. So tell us, how goes the journey, and has it only been a bed of roses, or have you seen some other challenges?
It's exhausting. It's terrible. Everyone always says like, oh, is this your first business? I'm like, it's my last business, I can tell you that. But no, I mean, it's an experiment, Aaron. And, you know, we'll see if it works. We've built incredible demand, but we're doing something that's really brand new. I mean, every machine we bring in, we have to build or retrofit. No one's ever done this before here in the US. And that's not an easy path to trod, but I think what makes it easier is one thing that has been done before and has been really revolutionized is aquaculture. So the growing side of it is you know, on the water has been very exciting to see the benefits, and it's been very exciting to see that not only are we kind of removing carbon and nitrogen from the water column, and that kelp halo is helping shell-bearing organisms like oysters and clams and mussels, but it's also helping with an adaptation strategy. Now, the big question will be like, how many uses can we find for kelp? And right now our product lines for retail are distributed across the country, Whole Foods, Sprouts, Wegmans, Mom's, all those places. And we're making kelp very accessible and easy to use through smoothie cubes and fermented seaweed salads that you can kind of put a fork in and eat. But the question that there's so much more that kelp can do in addition to that, you know, can we have that chemical created alginate actually made out of line grown seaweed in the US? Can we make textiles out of kelp? Can we make plastic out of kelp? What can we do with this product that can be beyond food uses? Are we able to feed it to cows? Are we able to feed it to pigs? We're seeing significantly reduced mortality with fermented kelp for pigs and piglets. There are so many uses for it. And I think for better or for worse, we're on the cutting edge of it here because we're the supplier. Our food brand is, you know, the highest quality kelp. It's kind of a very different beast, but it's, you know, 4 ounce kelp cubes is not going to have me get 400 farmers in the water. But what will is if we find really high value, high volume uses for fermented kelp for pig feed and for plastics and for alginates. If we figure that out, then our economic impact on the coast of Maine will be unmatched.
So Chris, oysters, you know, on the environmental side, oysters have definitely begun in mainstream media making a name for themselves as environmental warriors. Each mollusk filtering up to 50 gallons of seawater a day. They bond together to create natural reefs to protect shorelines and cities, and they obviously act as great neighbors in key marine estuaries to keep oceans thriving with biodiversity. But these restoration practices are pretty far afield from the ocean farming practices of raising oysters to, you know, to create food here, to create good food. Is your team at Island Creek Oysters, or is the industry involved in these marine ecosystem restoration projects via oysters?
It's a great question, Aaron. We are in two ways. The first that really hits home for us at Island Creek is, you know, the whole point of this conversation right around regenerative aquaculture is that the commercial farms themselves have positive environmental impacts on the environment. And one of the things we've found is that, you know, the restoration projects are great, and we support them with seed and with broodstock. And there's programs that were started during the pandemic to buy backstock from oyster growers to populate the restoration projects. But, you know, the restoration projects at this point don't really harness the power of private industry and profit, essentially, to scale. So we've seen those efforts are growing. There's the Billion Oyster Project in New York. They've been at it for the better part of a decade now. Mass Oyster Project here. The Nature Conservancy has waded in a big way with a lot of money from the federal government, from Pew and other kind of large funding sources to grow the restoration projects. So we've been big supporters of that. But one of the things that we've kind of dove deeper on is to actually try to validate some of the claims we make as an industry about the positive environmental benefits of a commercial farm. And the questions we're really trying to answer is, how does that stack up to a wild reef naturally occurring, or to a synthetic reef that's, you know, made by an NGO running a restoration project? And also, what can we do from those learnings as growers to adjust husbandry practices and other kind of, let's say, secondary impacts from just our presence out in the marine environment to, you know, minimize the negative outfall of having someone out there harvesting and kind of the activity on the farms, and also optimize the things that we are getting, like nitrogen removal and habitat creation. So one of the ways we've done that is to partner with the Nature Conservancy here in Massachusetts and Northeastern University to do now a study that's about to enter its fourth year on quantifying, you know, through scientific methods, the ecosystem value of a commercial shellfish farm. And the results we've seen are really promising. We have, you know, fish recruitment, there's a lot of enhanced activity. But one of the, you know, a great example, one of the questions we really wanted to, you know, to dig in on was, okay, is that just like a fish attraction device? You know, as we all know, fish are attracted to structure, whether it's good for them or not. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're creating more fish as a result. So really what we were looking for is this a nursery ground for fish? Are we seeing higher survival from species of commercial and ecological value like striped bass or black bass because there's a commercial shellfish farm in an area where there was once just a big sand flat. And the results we've found have been really promising in that the farms are doing just that. But we have also found that different growing methods and different sites have a big impact on the level to which they're having an effect. So that's been a really, really fascinating project that we've kind of delved in on. And then, you know, parallel to that, we're trying to, you know, put a reef here in Duxbury off of our property and trying to, you know, shore up the efforts on the restoration side as well.
Is the reef inside the bay or is it on the surrounding, or how's that being set up?
Inside the bay. And the interesting thing is that, you know, as far as we know, for the last few hundred years, there's been no naturally occurring oysters in Duxbury Bay. One of the things that makes Duxbury such a great place to grow really high quality oysters is it's so cold compared to the rest of Cape Cod Bay. By orders of magnitude, we're 10, 12 degrees cooler on a hot summer day than it is in a place like Wellfleet, which is the other, you know, obviously really well-known oyster appellation around here. In Wellfleet, they have a big wild population because of that warm water. But here in Duxbury, we don't. We have clams, we have mussels, we have scallops, we have other things, but oysters really need to get into some pretty warm, soupy water to spawn. But as we've seen the water in general warming up, and also just the presence of, you know, 30, 40, 50 million oysters on the farms in Duxbury Bay, we have seen some natural recruitment, which leads us to believe that if we could put a reef alongside or in close proximity to the farms, we could, again, kind of, you know, bring a little bit more oomph to the number of shellfish that are in the water in a passive way, which would have great ecological benefits.
Bree, one of the words that's commonly used or tossed around in the regenerative space is the word sequestering carbon, sequestering, right? So it's a bit of a myopic point of view on
the benefit. S-word.
Yes, there you go. There you go. You've been reading my notes here. So yes, the S-word. So, you know, I'm intrigued because it's a myopic perspective on the benefits of regen, but it's got a lot of oomph behind it. There's a lot of interest. There's carbon markets behind it. And I know you veer away from that word. Is it that it's overblown and bringing in questionable players? Is it that, carbon and kelp really are only storing it for a short period until you eat it, so it really doesn't get the benefit? What is it? You know, I drink gluten-free orange juice, so why not carbon bomb sea green smoothie cubes? Go for it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and I'm interested to know what Chris feels about this as well, because I think he's probably lambasted with this as well. But I think we as human beings are always more attracted to the medicine that can make us feel better than actually changing our habits to be healthier. And we know that from pharmaceuticals, right? If you can take a pill that makes it okay for you to get blasted drunk four nights a week, people will plan on taking that pill rather than stop drinking. This is the same thing with carbon. We want to find the silver bullet that cleans up our mess without us having to actually change the mess that we're making. And all these carbon suck ideas and how that's going to somehow fundamentally change the world. We can just keep pumping fossil fuels into the planet and don't worry because kelp's going to suck it up and take it away. It's all for naught. We need to change our habits. And I think the benefit of kelp and oysters in the same word, I would say that the three best foods that you can eat on the planet, and I will stand by this forever, and I think a lot of scientists would as well, are aquacultured mussels, aquacultured oysters, and aquacultured seaweed. We're all removing carbon from the water. We're all doing this with zero arable land, zero fresh water, zero pesticides. We're those three products grow more efficiently than any terrestrial food, especially terrestrial proteins, which are just garbage for the environment. And so you're actually making the planet better by eating them, and you're replacing something on your plate that is terrible for the environment. I mean, even the best terrestrial food, I've saw it on panels before with people talking about regenerative cow farming. And I'm like, okay. Or just don't eat cows. I do eat cow, I do eat meat, but you know, I think what we can actually say about seaweed and clams and oysters and mussels is that this is actually making the environment better. It is the best thing for your health, for the planet, for these coastal communities, and it replaces other things on your plate that are negative for the environment. That's a pretty bold statement. And it's the best, in my view, that's the best thing, like, that I can't imagine anything better to say. And then people are out there saying, and it sequesters carbon. But let's talk about what sequestering means. That means it goes away forever. So kelp, when you plant it out, and Chris can speak to oysters because I know much less about that. But when you plant kelp in the water on lines, when you inoculate lines to put it in the middle of the water, when it grows for 6 months, which is how long we grow it, it is sucking up carbon and nitrogen from the water. When we pull that out, we're removing that carbon and nitrogen from the water. And when you think about how much carbon that is, and we do have some data on this, it's in the tens of pounds for every acre. which there is not that much carbon in the water. So it's not actually removed, you know, it's removing a lot. When you say tens of pounds, that's actually quite a bit. And what that carbon is doing that's in the water that's being absorbed because there's so much excess carbon in the air, that is changing the pH of the ocean and making it more acidic. So that kelp is removing that carbon and nitrogen in that kelp halo where it is planted. Now, as we know, the ocean's not static. As soon as you take that kelp out of the water, the ocean moves around. And yes, we remove some of that carbon from the water temporarily. What we also know is when you plant mussels or oysters underneath that kelp halo during that, you know, during that 6 months of growing, the shell strength on those organisms can be up to 2 times as strong just in that 6 month period. So we've tested this a little bit on oysters. We've tested it a lot on mussels in partnership with Bigelow Laboratories. And we've found that the shell strength, because we're reducing the acidity so much in that kelp halo, we're seeing significantly stronger shells in those mussels. And that, similar to feeding your kids well in the first 5 years of life, if you do that at the beginning of the life cycle of mussels, their shell strength stays much stronger than what it would otherwise be over their lifetime, because they have that fundamental basis as the kelp is kind of protecting them from that ocean acidification. Once you eat kelp, you don't store that carbon in your body. If you bury kelp, it's not being stored there permanently. So it's not permanently sequestering anything, but it is doing massive ecosystem benefits at that point. And there are people who talk about sinking kelp to the bottom of the ocean is going to sequester carbon. But as Chris and I both know, the scariest thing we can possibly think about is throwing a bunch of lines in the water to drift out in the ocean and hope that it sinks. We know more about the face of the moon than we do about the bottom of the ocean, the deep ocean. So there needs to be a lot more study on that before we start making any claims about what that could possibly do. And that's why I call it the S word, is because why can't we just talk about all the amazing things it does do? And it replaces things on the plate that are doing negative, that are having a negative carbon impact. So it is, and I think that that's where we all just want to kind of take the pill to make ourselves feel better than actually getting to the root of the problem. And one of the ways that kelp is helping mitigate some climate change is actually replacing negative carbon sucks on the plate. And Chris, I'm interested if you're having these conversations as well.
Yeah, 100%. I have one question for you. That drunk pill you mentioned, that doesn't exist, right? Just want to confirm.
It doesn't, you know, it might out there, but I don't know of it. I would also probably, I'm victim of this as well. I'd probably also take it as well.
Sorry, just checking.
I heard a smoothie, a kelp smoothie really does do the job of helping you.
It does. Yeah, I hear kelp smoothie removes right? hangovers.
That's amazing.
So the minute after you drink it.
Well, those are all good points, Bree. And I think, 100% on the carbon front. You know, oysters do a much less effective job than kelp does at kind of locking up carbon. The upside to oysters is that the shells do hold the carbon for quite some time. So we talk a lot about, you know, there's carbon credits for timberland and things like that. And ultimately, those trees are managed, generally speaking, and they get turned into paper and taken down. And to your point, the carbon is not locked up forever. You know, with oyster shells, you know, you can put them on your driveway and they'll be there, you know, for centuries. So there's some upside there and something we've been exploring on how to better utilize the shells, which are kind of our biggest contribution to the waste stream, for, you know, direct use of our product. So, that's a really interesting conversation. I think the other thing, you know, you mentioned that, is an interesting kind of question to throw back at you, is this concept of the enhancement that these species get by being grown in close proximity to each other. And I think the context, you know, the kind of picture I'll paint is that within aquaculture, as I see it, there's these kind of two, if we're going to make aquaculture the sustainable food source for the future, there's these two battling factions, right? And one is, you know, we just hack our way around the environment. And the way we do that, you see that in terrestrial protein with lab grown meat and with hothouses for tomatoes, where the environment can be completely controlled and the energy is sourced sustainably. And in aquaculture, we're seeing it with closed system farms, also known as recirculating aquaculture systems, or RAS. And there's two or three big projects that are happening in Maine right now based around that. We've seen a lot in Northern Europe, some of which run almost exclusively on sustainable energy. It's very promising. But these are larger corporations that are, you know, raising hundreds of millions of dollars and creating these facilities. I think there's a lot to recommend that. I think one of the cool things about it is in the value chain, these corporations are actually the producers, whereas a lot of times they just kind of straddle the value chain and they're providing genetics and seed, or yearlings or whatever, and then they're buying it back on the other end. But ultimately, they're small hold producers that are growing the stuff. So there's lots to talk about there. However, the competing promising technology looks and feels a lot different, but it is this concept of polyculture. I took a trip a couple of years ago on an Eisenhower fellowship that I did to probably the most famous example of a polyculture operation, which is Vete La Palma in the south of Spain. They have this incredible managed ecosystem with where they grow shrimp and a variety of fish species and shellfish, and they have, you know, wild birds that come in, and it's a biodynamic, hands-off approach to aquaculture, and it's really just a gem. I think that there are big questions around the scalability of that. Vete La Palma is such a unique situation. I don't know that it could be replicated in the way that these, you know, onshore closed system facilities could. And then on a smaller scale, we've seen a lot of people in the shellfish world try to grow kelp and fish and other species alongside. And some of what we found is that it's hard enough just to grow oysters, let alone trying to grow another species or two alongside of it. I think the lobster situation that you guys have landed on is so great because there's some seasonality to it, where the kelp high season is the lobster low season for a lot of lobster fishermen. So it really makes sense. Whereas with shellfish aquaculture, you're kind of growing for 52 weeks a year. So whatever you're doing operationally, you need to kind of run parallel to that. So I would love to hear, you know, Aaron and Bree, both your thoughts on, you know, this concept of like, are we going lab grown? Are we going closed system? Is that the future? Big scale, big investment, big corporations, or are we going with a more sensitive environmental approach? But perhaps that requires a lot more figuring out on the scalability and profitability end, which is this concept of polyculture.
Yeah, I think that's a great question, Chris. And we're actually working, two of our partner farmers are also mussel farmers. And mussels and kelp grow very well together because they're in the same depth. As you know, oysters are growing, at least in New England, oysters are growing much more in much shallower depth. We've seen some oyster growers throughout the Northeast kind of try to grow kelp in those depths. And that kelp is not usable really for food because it's not clean in the same way, right? It's not as far as water quality, but I mean, there's organisms and all sorts of stuff. Once it touches the bottom, it gets all grimy. I mean, you know what's down there. It's, yeah, you know, it's snails and things like that. So there are people out there trying to grow kelp in 12-foot waters or 5-foot waters. And I'm kind of scratching my head wondering what they're going to do with it other than fertilizers and things, which can provide really good ecosystem services for oysters, actually. And it can make the core business a ton stronger because of exactly what you said. There's huge ecosystem benefits by having the kelp around those shell-bearing organisms. But that mussels and kelp seem to be a much better fit, at least here in New England, because they're at the same depth and you can plant. Most of the culture up here is either bottom culture or rope culture, raft culture. And so you can kind of plant the kelp over the mussels if it's bottom culture, or around the rafts, if it's rope culture. And that is actually a fairly easy task to do. Nothing's easy on the ocean. That is, I'm saying that with a little bit of tongue in cheek. It's not easy, but we know how to do it. I think there are some larger scale and small scale trials in New Hampshire around finfish, oysters, mussels, seaweed. I think they're fascinating to see. I think it feels a little bit like a square peg in a round hole, but I think that particularly around fish farming, if we're talking about planting kelp around those farms for remediation and not selling that kelp for human consumption, but selling it for other purposes, or then turning it into the fish feed, we can actually see some really dynamic ecosystem benefits there for the health of the ocean. So I think there's still a lot to learn on how it could be used as a buffer for the primary source of income around, you know, oysters and fish, but also how it can be an ecosystem cleanup effort around fish farming. So there's still a long way to go on all that. And the studies out there are fascinating.
That's really interesting. I think that, you know, that's one thing that bears mentioning, Bree. I think you hit the nail on the head with the mussel example. It's just that, you know, so much of our challenges in this sphere are about taking great ideas and then confronting the realities of actually implementing
them. Yes.
And, but I mean, there's some operational realities, just the nature of growing mussels is in my mind anyway, from, you know, my aquaculture background, so much closer to growing kelp, where mussels are a high volume, you know, they grow like weeds, but they're a high volume crop that is relatively low unit value.
Yeah,
you're really just trying to grow bulk. And whereas the oysters are this, like, you know, we're trying to groom them into these perfect little, you know, saltwater bombs to put on a raw bar at a restaurant. And
right. And people eat one at a time, right? They're like, oh, this one oyster, and they eat them slowly. And right, exactly.
And it's like, you just think about the infrastructure required for both, and they're vastly different. Whereas mussels and kelp, it's like, you got to move weight. You have suspended lines. Like, you have, you can use the same, I mean, it sounds silly, but it's like, you can use the same boat to grow for a mussel farm as you can for a kelp farm, it would seem. So I think that makes a lot of sense. And yeah, it's very exciting in a lot of ways.
Chris, you know, I hope we go the way of polyculture for systems change, but obviously there's a lot of money behind other types of systems change. You mentioned controlled environment growing for indoor and glasshouse production. You mentioned lab grown meat. You know, people are interested in it. And what I find intriguing, or at least as an opportunity, is that we can engage consumers in this, and you can maybe ride the coattails of some of the enthusiasm towards the systems change in food, of opening up the value-based approach. And I read that you guys down in Island Creek had recently purchased the Windsor House, which is an iconic restaurant which sits across the street from your campus. And reviews look great. Everything looks exciting. And you really are tapping again to this lifestyle of contemporary food, which is more connected to environmental and social consciousness of the consumer. And like Row 34 and the shop up in Portland, you've really integrated these experiences. It's somewhat maybe part of your magic to get engaged with those consumer base. So how important do you think the regenerative ocean farming movement, or at least the lifestyle and the stories behind it, are in actually integrating that into your overall narrative to get more people to care about the systems change and to care about polyculture?
It's huge, Aaron. I think one of the things we've found is that, you know, people have an endless willingness to engage in the storytelling aspect of their food. You know, that's been a major revelation of the last, you know, 10 or 20 years. And again, in reality, it's we would try as best we can, whether it's at an event that we host or here in the restaurant. I'm sitting in the Windsor House right now, tableside with a server who has this piece of fish on a plate that they're about to drop for a guest, and that fish really arrived there via me traveling to Europe or South America on a fellowship a few years ago, meeting a farmer, finding it so compelling, working through distribution channels and looking at carbon footprints and trying to figure out how to get that fish here, driving our kitchen crazy. You know, there's an epic behind every single, you know, piece of protein that hits a table here. And that is an incredible opportunity for us. And ultimately, even if that guest walks away with just a kernel of knowing that, wow, that fish that I just ate was delicious and it came from a farm, that alone is a victory for us. So it's a huge, you know, creating these platforms has been, I think, a huge value to add. And we, one of the reasons I come to work every day is being able to start those conversations and educate people, you know, through farm tours and through all the hospitality that we do. That's really the point. However, it's baby steps. And I think that, we always have to keep that in mind, is that if a diner walks out of here with just a kernel more knowledge or a consciousness around the fish that they're eating, then that's a victory, and we have to count it as such. But certainly we're in it for the long haul. That's for sure.
Yeah. And Bree, how about you? Maybe you could share, you know, as a closing thought here, how important the storytelling side of this is, from the southern coast of Maine to the hardworking lobstermen to the sequestering carbon into to the kelp, really, but more of the collective and how this different model of aquaculture and regenerative ocean farming is the way of the future. How are you engaging consumers with that storytelling?
I mean, the reason we exist is to have more resilience for Maine's working waterfront communities. And at the end of the day, that's the story we tell. Our tactics to get there are about driving demand for our products, making delicious products, advertising those products. And I think we find that people come to our company for number one, health, number two, taste, and number three, what we're building. And so if that means we need to lean in on the taste story more than anything, knowing that it's going to benefit what we're building, then that's what we lean into. And I think people are really inspired by hope right now, because I think people can feel pretty under siege by the amount of bad news that's out there. And what Chris is building and what we're building, like, this is hope. This is future. This is good. This is good for the planet. And it's good for the consumer. And I think that's a story that we'd like to tell, and people come along with us, and we need to do it in a way that you know, people don't feel like they're being slapped in the face with climate activism every time they try to go to the grocery store, but instead something that tastes good and, hey, I'm doing something good for the climate. So we do a lot of storytelling, but we do it with a soft touch, because we know that people want that hope and they want it in doses they can take. And we know what we're doing at the end of the day. And all we're doing is hustling to get more farmers in the water. But the way to do that's going to be making sure we meet people where they are.
Palatable, bite-sized hope and potential and optimism. That's great stuff. Well, Bree and Chris, I can't thank you both enough for taking the time to share such insights. I learned a great deal, and I know our listening audience will as well. So thank you both.
Thank you, Aaron. It was good to talk to you, Chris.
Bree, it was a pleasure. And just want to say I'm such a tremendous fan of what you guys are doing up there. And I can't wait to see where it leads. So thanks, Aaron, for convening the conversation. It was a blast.